Hey, good morning, Philip. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, good morning.
Hey.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm really excited today to talk to a colleague, now friend, Philip Agee, and he's at Virginia Tech. All kinds of fun stuff we're going to talk about today in terms of building interfaces and what the heck a building interface is and some of the cool research he's been doing. So, real quick, you want to give a quick intro about who you are, or where you from?
Sure, thanks. I'm Philip Agee. I am an assistant professor in the Myers-Lawson School of Construction at Virginia Tech and the assistant director of the Virginia Center for Housing Research. So I teach and conduct research on a lot of building systems, kind of, theory and application, applied building science, human factors engineering, and my background, I kind of grew up in the construction industry. Really not because I had the strong motivation to work in industry. My dad's an electrical engineer, my mom's an accountant, but I was wanted to work outside, and it was like construction was the first place you could make like $10 or $12, right? So I'm probably dating myself based on how much I was getting paid. But I like I like solving problems and building stuff. And so I went to work out of undergrad for kind of a I had a big interest in sustainability and kind of conservation and things like that because I love the outdoors so much. And I went to work for a company that was doing kind of integrated design consulting for mainly house, like residential, single family, multifamily, some small commercial, but energy modeling and kind of design reviews, HERS ratings, building inspections, kind of light commissioning, building diagnostics. I got to get more into like kind of building forensics and solving problems with diagnostic tools and equipment. And at the same time, I was working on a lot of very high performance residential buildings. And what we saw were, as the buildings were becoming more efficient, the heating and cooling end uses were really kind of, we understood those pretty well and where a lot of the variability in outcomes was, back in that time, we were just saying occupant behavior, right? We were saying,
Yeah.
hey, we kind of threw our hands up in the air and said, well, that's just the people part. We can't control that. So
Silly
we're,
people.
yeah, silly people, right? Like, the people in the buildings part, right? And
Yeah.
so as I was also at the same time, I had a great opportunity in that job. And I was my learning, I was never that great of a student growing up, but I always had a passion for learning. And the first 7 or 8 years of my industry career, my just learning kind of was like, growing exponentially. And I felt like I was plateauing. So I was kind of looking for an opportunity to kind of go back to graduate school, maybe get a master's in like architectural engineering. And I came back to Tech and, or got recruited to come to Tech and do research on some of the projects I was working on and had no intention to stay for a PhD. And then just saw all the opportunities there were here and then ended up staying to do a PhD in industrial and systems engineering, which is, like a lot of engineering disciplines is quite broad, right? So within industrial engineering, my focus was in human factors of systems and product design. And so that's kind of led me on this path to, I mean, I still work in very applied building science problems, sealing ductwork, proving building closures, but most of where I'm interested in the day-to-day research and get to work with smart people like you is thinking about how people interact with buildings and particularly, at different scales, I'm interested in how people interact with specific interfaces, right? So
Yeah.
we, because that's a big gap right now. We don't know much about that.
Yeah. So real quick, for those who don't know, can you define what human factors is? Like, what does that mean?
Yeah, so in human factor, okay, so I'll give you the kind of the high level overview is human factors is really looking at solving problems through the lens of understanding the limits and abilities of humans from a physical, physiological, and psychological perspective, right? So it's really born out of crisis coming out of World War II, where we were starting to put people into particularly airplanes and flying at higher altitudes. Right. And we were at the upper bounds of kind of humans, physical and you put somebody in 35,000 feet of altitude and now the temperature is so cold and it impacts the way that they can process information. And you need to be able to process information when you're flying a plane at 35,000 feet. So,
Yeah.
fast forward to we wanting to put people in space and we really had to start to understand the way that people interact with systems. It's really the merging of psychology and engineering, right? Cognitive psychology or your cognition and engineering, or some people call it cognitive engineering. So yeah, the merging of those two fields, right, is where a lot of human factors kind of work happens.
Yeah, awesome. And then you already mentioned interfaces and how that
Yeah.
relates to all that. And what are some examples of different interfaces?
Yeah, so we really have interfaces all around us, and the good ones we never really think about, right? And the pain in the butt ones we get frustrated by, and we don't we probably end up avoiding them out of, right? But an example could be as simple as a door handle, or an interface in a building could be the way that you wayfinding in an airport. There's a big push for a lot of our building systems around controls. These are more digital interfaces now, right? So we have thermostats, lighting controls, energy management systems, even more traditionally on maybe on the facilities management, like work order systems, right? So it can be very broad, but it does kind of take it down from like it kind of allows us to go deeper than just saying, okay, the people interact with the building to people interact with a specific part of a building. And now I can set up a study and evaluate specific interactions. I can go deeper and actually understand what people's attitudes, beliefs, perceptions are, right? And that's very valuable, not just from a traditional kind of engineering, we want to make predictions, but if you are in the design world, right, and you want to make design systems that are easy to use for people and that will be accepted, then it's helpful to be able to get down to that kind of discrete human technology interaction level.
And then are you finding in some of the things you've done that people may be interacting with those interfaces for reasons you didn't expect?
Sure. I mean, variety is a spice of life, right? And I think that the challenge that we all face is that, and some of us are better and that better at this than others. I'm better on it at some days than I am other days, but we all have biases in the way that we view the world, right? So what I really enjoy about kind of the human factors world, I've been guilty of this sitting in traditional architecture or engineering construction kind of related meetings, and somebody will say, particularly in a design stage, well, from my perspective, it's like, well, that's wrong from the get, right? Like if you're coming at it from your perspective, you're not designing these systems, products, or buildings for yourself, right? And so what I really like about the human factors and kind of human-centered design world is that it's the acknowledgement that the people out there aren't just like you, right? And so you really, in order to be successful, you have to understand who you're designing for. And a lot of systems and other technologies and products, we do this really well. Like you have an industrial design background, right? Like this is day one industrial kind of design, interior design, right?
Interior design. Yeah, interior
Yeah,
design.
right. But so you're trying to understand like what people perceive as what they enjoy, what makes them happy, what things like that. And we have a tendency to focus more on traditional kind of construction management or civil engineering on, the very linear based production, sequencing processes and, quality control or quality management, cost management, schedule management, right? And there's not, although people are involved in that, there's not a lot of focus on, the people part of it.
We were actually just meeting with some students yesterday and going over a design, and I was surprised that they hadn't yet thought about the people who would be in the building at all. And I was like,
Yeah.
the whole point of this building is for the people who will be in the building. And so you have to think about all those different touch points and all those different interactions that they might have, and those interactions kind of stem from different reasons. There might
Yeah.
be one day you want lights on for some reason and another day don't. And, there's just kind of, like you said, that variability that has to be dialed into there as
Yeah.
well.
And a lot of it too is what I like about it is, these are big complex problems, but we have ways to think about it in terms of like the context of the interaction. So, for example, in human factors, most of the human factors literature developed out of kind of an occupational context, right? We want to put people in space. Well, that astronaut, it sounds like a cool, it's a job. I mean, it's an awesome job to be an astronaut, right? But then that knowledge kind of diffused into other aeronautical applications, like an airline pilot, right? And it diffuses into maybe the automotive industry with truck drivers or other, agriculture or other types of systems. So, that's a very occupational context, right? So sometimes like the human behavior, the human piece of it seems like so kind of stochastic or so random, but you can start to characterize this by, okay, is this something that somebody's doing at work? Are they in a building where they're going to like their office like I am now? Or is this a consumer context where like, hey, I just got home from work and I don't just like, hang out in collared dress shirts at home, believe it or not, right? So just contextualizing it for the type of building that you're in makes it, now we can make it easy because we understand the context. And knowing that a lot of our kind of human factors knowledge is really kind of grounded in an occupational context. Even a lot of like the thermal, some of the early thermal comfort research was around, was in an occupational context, right? In a military application, in a factory context, right? Before we think about it in a consumer context.
So you and I think the first time we met was at one of the International Energy Agency annex meetings, and I can't for life of me remember which city that particular meeting was in. But we've been interface buddies now for a little while and had a chance to write a chapter about interfaces and defining characteristics of those. And what are some of the different characteristics that you think designers really need to pay attention to when designing interfaces, like big picture?
Yeah. Okay. So just point correction. I actually met you. I was a fanboy of Julia Day. I met you at an ASHRAE conference. You presented somewhere and gave a great presentation on some mixed methods research. And I asked you a question and I came up to you, like after a presentation when you present to 80 people, right? And then there's a lot of people. So I met you very briefly. I knew very much about your work before I met you, right? I was a big fanboy. I don't remember which annex meeting because I think it was in the COVID times when we first kind of start
Man,
working on.
my timeline's fuzzy then. Man,
Yeah,
sorry.
no, that's okay. Just I want the audience to know that I was a fanboy of Julia Day before we became we worked together. So on the interface side of it, there is, I think it's human nature to add to, I call it add-itis, right? And so in interfaces, right, we have a tendency, and designers have a tendency to just add stuff, right? And so a good kind of a contextual example would be thermostats, right? So you see thermostats that have like 7-day forecasts in them, right? Which I can imagine like the designer sitting around a table, right? And it's probably driven by mechanical engineers, right? And they're like, okay, well, the interactions with weather are really going to drive energy use in the buildings. Let's put the 7-day forecast in. But I've got a lot of apps on my phone and I'm not clicking on my thermostat app to check out what the 7-day forecast is. So, as I've been on this path and not for around interface of evaluation, there's beauty in simplicity. Because life is hard and life is busy, and the amount of clutter that is in an interface impacts how well people can perceive it and then have a kind of a response selection, right? So, I mean, just look at the way if you open up a Google, a web search and go to Google, right? The search query is in the middle of the page, and there's really nothing else around it, and so they recognize very early on that there's a need to keep things simple. And so visual clutter is a impacts interface design, particularly in we're talking kind of visual displays and digital interfaces right now. Visual clutter is a big deal, right? And the color choices you make are a big deal. The level of contrast you provide you pe people is a big deal because while you and I are motivated to study this stuff and we're to go deep on it, like most people wake up and they want to think about fun stuff, right? Like what they're going to do that day or picking their kids up or accomplishing some task. They're not thinking about like the nuances of an interface. We shouldn't think about it, right? We should be able to go through our day and a good interface makes your life easier. And a bad interface makes your life really frustrating.
It's blown my mind. I think we both have kiddos right around the same age, but my 2-year-old, she can just cruise around my phone like nobody's business, and that's a good interface. Like
Yeah.
my 2-year-old can figure out how to FaceTime her grandma and, turn on and off lights. Then that kind of intuitive, simple, all those different characteristics depending on what the interface is, it's really important. But as soon as you get into a building, like I'm sitting in one right now recording this, and there's different switches on the wall that aren't labeled, that have like 6
Yeah.
buttons, and you have no idea what's going on. Fun to play with for my daughter, but it wouldn't be intuitive, like just a simple
Yeah.
light switch is.
Yeah. If you have to have a manual to explain how to use your system, right, or your interface, then that's probably not the most ideal design. And in a lot of ways, and the built environment is different than a lot of maybe traditional kind of an iPad or other technologies. And there are elements of usability and kind of interfaces and kind of intuitiveness that are designed into, they're just kind of baked in. So like if you walk into a closet, right, and you open the door and the light switch is like kind of near the door handle, that makes it the closet more usable, right? If you put
Right.
the as opposed to putting the switch on the other side of the wall and you have to reach for it when it's dark, right? But we don't intuitive like that's just kind of a heuristic that's built into the way that we do things. It's not something I think that's overly intentional, right? Like an
Yeah.
electrician was probably taught or fussed at the one time when they did it the wrong way, and then they learned just that's why you do it, not knowing why,
Yeah.
right? But in the more of the kind of what I'm really interested in now in exploring around this topic is the fact that for the longest time we've had one building, and I'm talking about interfaces in the context of kind of building controls, controlling lights, controlling thermostats, right? Understanding your energy use, managing maybe, your indoor air quality, things like that. We've
Right.
had kind of fixed visual displays as the primary interaction point or interface, right? And then now that we have, ubiquitous mobility, or, for layman's terms, we have apps and cell phones and smartphones in our pocket. We can now have those controls and remote control effectively, right? And what we're seeing is a lot of times the controls aren't clear as far as the same model between the fixed visual display and what's in the app, right? Oh, then you add like an Alexa or some type of auditory interface, right? And so you're compounding the complexity of the interaction if it's not simple and similar, right?
Yeah.
And this is where we don't really have, back to some of the work that other folks in the annex, do and contribute to around like occupancy schedules, right? Like there's no way to really understand like if somebody is going to change the temperature, are they going to reach for the thermostat on the wall, or are they going to reach for their phone? And that's actually a study that I've got a student running right now where we're literally just giving somebody the choice, and it's an
Yeah.
actual thermostat on the wall, and then there's a phone sitting right there, and we're just saying, we're giving them tasks and asking and then observing which one they go for. And they're probably demographic drivers or age drivers or things like that type things that drive that. But right now we don't have a good enough understanding that we can then put that into like a simulation tool and say, hey, 90% of the people at this confidence interval are going to reach for a phone to change their thermostat, right?
Right.
So I think ultimately that's from the science standpoint where we're trying to go.
Yeah, so you mentioned, well, and I know about it because I took the survey, I remember. But you did a really great study recently about thermostats, and you just mentioned visual clutter a little while ago, and it reminded me of that. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about kind of what you did, your methodology, why you're interested in doing that, and then what did you find?
Yeah, so I'll give acknowledgement first that most good ideas are borrowed, right? So a lot of my human factors pals and kind of engineering side of it, they're working on interfaces for luxury vehicles and for Boeing, or maybe not Boeing, maybe they should be working on quality control for Boeing, but they are working on interfaces in more complex systems than a
Yeah.
thermostat, right? And so we just borrowed a methodology or maybe variables that are important to understand when you're designing interfaces, and visual clutter is one of those, right? So if you're flying a plane and you need to be able to focus on we don't need unnecessary information in the display, because then that's something that's gonna it's literally gonna clutter when people are seeking or in visual search looking for information that they need in a high risk situation. So we ran a mixed method study where first we just wanted to catalog all the, in a consumer context, all these connected thermostats that utilities are really hoping are shave peak load. But really people are just buying because it makes their life easier, right? They can like lay on the couch and change the thermostat, so they get up and change the thermostat. And so we looked at some of these very aesthetic features around color contrast. We wanted to understand the level of standardization in the icons. So, what is used to represent heating? What is used to represent cooling? What is used to represent, the up or down for changing the thermostat? And so we did just some kind of descriptives to map those out. And then we did kind of an expert review and of from our colleagues within the annex that are interested in this stuff. And what we're finding are just, that within these thermostats, of the 50 or so that we looked at, there's like 30 different ways to change the temperature, right? And so
Yeah.
that, there's probably not that, 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 so there's a lack of standardization is one, right? Now, when you move over to the app side of the thermostat, that's kind of, I was talking about the fixed visual display. There's less variability in the way you can change the thermostat. And that's probably because some of these companies are just using third-party app developers. And like, you know, they kind of have a palette that they draw from, you know, as far as like colors and contrast, but we're still seeing the lack of kind of standardization. And interestingly, you'll see a lack of standard, you know, we have a brand X thermostat and their wall display looks like this and their app looks completely different, right? And
Yeah.
again, I just always go back to, and it's not very scientific, but it's just life. Life is hard, right? And like, I don't want to have to think about how, like, can I remember like how to change the thermostat on really two modalities of the same system, right? So
Looks
just
totally different.
that look completely different,
Yeah.
right? And so there's a need. I think some of that research has identified a need to go deeper on the impact of the icons. So we're just doing some work right now on mapping all the icons and then also doing interaction studies, right? So it's one thing to map them. It's another thing to kind of use humans to interact with these systems and tell us about their perceptions. So we can use pretty well-established human factors models like around human information processing or technology acceptance models and dig into kind of at the cognitive level. When people see this icon, what does it represent to them, right? If we put this icon and this icon next to each other, can they tease out that this is heating and cooling related or not, this is not? And so we're using, you know, kind of mixed methods where we're using like think aloud protocols and getting people to tell us what they think. And then
Yeah.
and also we're using eye trackers where we mount, you know, a set of glasses that have two infrared cameras in each lens that are measuring the direction of your pupil. So we calibrate it, watching what we're asking you where you're looking and gazing, but we're actually measuring where you're gazing. And so
Yeah.
as you, so it's pretty interesting.
That is interesting. I'm curious too. You mentioned this idea of standardization, and in my experience, there's kind of two camps. There's the folks that thinks that all the things should be standardized, and then there's another camp that's like, well, it's like creative freedom to I can design my app however I want to design my app, right? Or interface or whatever it is. I think I read something you did at some point, or at least talked to you about it, about how there's the standardization like in the automobile industry, right? And you know, if I go on a work trip and I rent a car and I get in that car and it's a different make than my own, I should understand like where the pedal is and what D means for drive. And you know, there's certain interfaces that we use in a lot of different, I guess, non-building areas that are standardized. And a lot of times we do that for safety, right? Like what are kind of your thoughts on standardization of different types of interfaces and like where it might be a good idea to start thinking about that, or not.
So I mean, I think you know it, where you see st the really a necessity of standardization is in high risk systems, right? So we see that like putting people in space, high risk, right?
Yeah.
Maybe before now we haven't thought about buildings from high risk, but if we're serious about kind of climate change or resiliency, we need to probably start thinking about buildings as like high risk systems in the sense that we need to be able to understand and make predictions and have reliable outcomes, right? So look, buildings aren't jazz music. Like the designer argument of like this is my palette. That I mean, I trust me, I don't like being told what to do. Never have, right? And so, but a building design, an interface design of a system control is not jazz music, right?
Yeah.
And it's there are times to be. I'm not trying to take anybody's creative palette away, but and I've talked about with this with some folks and maybe a large company that we all know and use to search on the internet that designs thermostats too. And I kind of said, hey, would you be against kind of some basic standardization of some icons? And they're very careful about what they say. And they're like, you know, there's some parts of it that we would never be for standardizing, right? Like, and that, 'cause that's where we feel like we are able to kind of advance, like kind of the human experience in life. But there are other parts of it that would be helpful to standardize because, you know, then we don't have to think about that part. You know,
Right.
so I think it's really what do we want to, you know, use our creative energy and attentional resources on? And what don't we, maybe as a way to think about it. And I would
Yeah.
suggest that like the parts of it that are critical to like human like performance, we don't want to use our creative energy on, right? Making something awesome and fun, let's make that the jazz song, right? Like
Yeah.
that's the part where we can go wild. And standards, you know, I have a love-hate relationship with standards. They're necessary, but gosh, they're such a pain in the butt, right? And so there's really no re we need more reason, right? As a researcher, this sounds silly to say. I mean, it's self-serving, not silly, but we need more research to justify the need for it, right? And so that's what I'm pretty motivated to work on now with you in the future with the Annex group, right? I think that there's and I think that we have a captive audience with folks, you know, with the folks that we have that are engaged with groups like ASHRAE.
Yeah.
And you know, again, life is hard. Like let's use the lil, you know, not to be overly engineered about it, let's use our 168 hours in the week to do fun
Yeah.
stuff, not think about how to change the thermostat. Or you know, I just went into a brand new building to give a presentation at Virginia Tech, and the lighting controls had six buttons on it just for a single light, right? And
Yeah.
the it was a guest lecture, and the professor was like, I've been in this room all semester, and you know, like I've not figured out how to use this light, right? And it's like, wow, that's, you know, that professor has so many things to focus on and use their, you know, their smarts for, and turning the light on in the room shouldn't be one of them,
Yeah.
you know?
Yeah, I hear you. I felt that yesterday actually. So many problems with light switches and interfaces in general. And that's one area that would be hugely helpful to have some kind of standardization or rationale between that.
Standardization and then also another piece I'm thinking about it from is one of the projects that we're working on right now is you know again in my house right there are four people that live in my house and there's we have you know two thermostats and you know of the four people only two people touch the thermostat myself and my wife and if I was to log the number of interactions that I have this is a part of it of human building interaction it's not just thinking about it from a design it's that there are quantitative ways to think about like how often do we have the interaction right and
Yeah.
so hey I go through doors every day right so increasingly I've been thinking about like you know because there again there's 168 hours in the week 8,760 in the year you want to be have you know put your time into places where you have big impacts and so it sounds silly, and it's not a digital interface, but on the toilet interface side, it is a really is an a very inclusive problem to try to solve. Where,
Yeah.
you know, everybody in my house uses the toilet multiple times a day, whereas people, you know, in my house maybe touch the thermostat twice a week, and it's only two of the four people. So we've been looking also at, you know, so I guess the other comment or kind of thread I'd pull would be it's not just about human computer interaction. You know, it also needs to be about some of the kind of more traditional. The, you know, and so traditional interfaces and interactions, and you know, when I put a student on looking at, like, go dig into the literature on human interaction with toilets and toilet advancements, right? Guess what? Like, the toilet is like one of the most important parts of a building system, and one of the reasons why we'll both live beyond our 30s, you know, from a health standpoint. Most of the scientific literature on toilets now is like about smart toilets that have like Bluetooth and like change, you know, do all these crazy kind of things. And I'm just like, oh my gosh, like talk about intellectual rot and just research for no research for research sake. You know, it's just like there's literally going to be data. Yeah, not to go down
More
that too far, but
buttons, way more
well,
buttons.
more buttons, right? And it's like, who wants buttons on a, like, don't touch that stuff. So we're doing some studies where we're trying to understand, you know, and this is where the sustainability piece of it kind of comes back, which kind of, you know, what drove me to a lot of stuff in the first place, which is, hey, you know, a good dual flush toilet is, we're motivated to do that because we want to save water. And I think I've never met anybody that wants to argue with me about saving water, right? But it's absolutely ignoring how people perceive interfaces or perceive interaction with a device or system that leads to systems like dual flush toilets that people don't understand how to use, right? And you shouldn't
Yeah.
have to be trained on how to use the technology that everybody in the industrialized society is going to use every single day, right? Like
Yeah.
those intuitive systems. So we've been digging into that, and that's been kind of fun. And that by far of all my research has been the most pun rich research that I've done to date, right? But it's also at the same time very inclusive research too, right?
I'll never forget last summer cruising around Germany and Philip was taking pictures of toilets and it was awesome because there were, I still remember there were some that we had a conversation about like I don't know what the dual like we're getting into this now. We're going there. But the dual flush, you know, like is it a bigger button for more water or less water? And it seems like that wasn't consistent. So us Americans on some toilets there, we're using more water because we didn't know which button to push.
Yeah,
So, yeah.
absolutely. And it's one of those well, this is where you see too, like as English speakers, we read left to right, top to bottom, right? So even if you're but not obviously everybody reads English or is that's where how that they were taught. So
Yeah.
even just the way that you perceive where you start. Yeah, that's been a really funny project that was never intentional, but it's just again following where you see the kind of the most daily interactions with the technology and then where they cross lines with kind of usability and large populations. And at the same time, people laugh about it. And I'm a big believer in like, don't take yourself very seriously, take what you do seriously. And that project more so than any others, I still have people I'll talk about that with. And then I'll randomly 6 months later, I'll get an email or a text message picture with from somebody that's like, this is the most ridiculous toilet. And like no other research project I've ever done has people have done that. Like
Yeah.
I can four or five people like that, have randomly reached out to me and just sent me pictures. So we've actually built a database of about 60 toilet interfaces. And then I've got a student that's clustered those into kind of, this type, right? Like maybe like 5 to 6 clusters of these different type of dual interfaces. Some
Yeah.
of them are like, like the classic, like bigger circle next to the smaller circle. Some of them are right, like kind of squares that are next to each other, and they have like
Yeah.
maybe a long line of. And then we're running some eye tracking studies where we're asking people, and even just thinking about what we ask them, like for the interaction, like what do you say, a one or a two? Well, not in all cultures it's called a one or a two. So we ended up like for the prompts, it's like, hey, is this a a liquid waste or solid waste, right? So, so we were doing some interaction studies. We made these prototypes that are scaled to kind of the standard size based off the specifications of it. Studies right now with the eye tracker on how people are perceiving those, right? And again, so you can see how this could go not just from thermostats, but to toilet interfaces, door
Yeah.
handles, right? All of this stuff is really wide open in the built environment. And I think, that's really exciting to me because it means we have a good trajectory and it impacts everyone, right? Like I
Yeah.
think that's what's kind of cool about it. My
Yeah.
90-year-old grandmother, it impacts her even if she, isn't that interested in the type of stuff that we work on together.
Yeah, that's true. I think the impact is huge, but also it gives you kind of like a simple interface to test these different ideas out and kind of understand all of these different variables you've talked about. I mean, there's a lot of people who would have never thought about like reading left to right in some cultures versus others, and how
Yep.
we then start to process. And you talked a little bit before about this technology acceptance model and then human information processing, and like kind of going back to like we want to use less and less kind of resources or like brain juice, if I'm going to go real layman's terms there, to try to figure out what to do when we're interacting with our space. So yeah, you're doing some
Yeah.
super exciting stuff, and I love hearing about
Yeah, well, you are too. I mean, I've always been, it's fun. It's been a good, the Annex has been a really great, rich, collaborative group. My colleagues that work in maybe digital twins, and I don't sense that their communities are as kind of collaborative, right?
Yeah.
Like there might be an Annex around it, but it's definitely, the Annex has definitely had a significant impact on me professionally and personally. I've met a lot of people that I admire, like you and Liam and other folks in there. And at the same time, I do feel like we're all contributing to solving big problems. And it's helped advance my career from a standpoint of being able to, make connections from an international, research perspective. And that's kind of what's needed to solve these complex problems, So I'm actually
Yeah.
giving a presentation tomorrow where, we have a human computer interaction group here at Virginia Tech, and they have kind of a big ideas seminar where they get everybody together. And what I'm trying to figure out, like, we need people with different perspectives, right? Like, so maybe we need somebody from fine arts or from anthropology or things like that, to think about it, because I'm coming at it from a very, kind of engineering perspective, right? I'm thinking of, I have to fight myself to not think about it just from like a purely efficiency or control logic standpoint too, right? It's like that's that, because that's, the PhD stands for permanent head damage. That's what's kind of been beat into my head, right? And so it's like, you need those people with different, kind of perspectives and not just the same perspective. And I think that that was kind of what I sensed as I was really early on in my career as like kind of an energy zealot, right? It's like, okay, well, we're going to do this if we can save, who cares what the people think? We're going to save X amount of kilowatt hours, right? And then you quickly realize that that's not what works. But we're also looking at the things like on the back end of these projects, like on the maintenance and kind of work order side of systems and how. So it doesn't just have to be in a consumer context, but we're actually looking at, okay, we have a net zero building. Congratulations, we're awesome. We did a great job. Now we have to maintain that net zero building, and like the people who maintain that, like they're typically completely reactive to problems, right? So we're doing some interesting work with like trying to understand how they enter data, and that's an interface, but it's in a work context, right? So like if you're sitting at a computer like we are, it's much easier to do things than if you're in an attic changing a radon fan out, right? And so that's some of the other kind of fun stuff we're doing.
Awesome. Well, I've got two last questions for you.
Okay.
Kind of big picture ones. Well, they can be little picture too if you want. So your choice, dealer's choice here. So we have, I would say, kind of two main audiences for this. There's definitely a lot of students on the design and construction side. And then we also have industry folks who listen. So engineers, operators, designers. What would be your advice to the students in terms of kind of key takeaways about interfaces? And
Oh,
then,
wow. Yeah.
on the flip side of that, for folks already in the industry who are already doing their thing, what's something you would maybe urge them to do to make buildings better for people?
Yeah. Okay. So maybe on the student side of it and the design side of it is, maybe bigger picture advice. So just stay curious, right? Be aware that like you're going to enter a workforce that is excited to have you and welcome you. And you need to be able to work with all sorts of different types of people. And it's okay if you suck at first at what you do, as long as you don't suck later, right? So it's okay to not be good at what you do, right? Like if you were really good at it, you wouldn't need to come to school to learn about it, right? And nobody knows everything about it when they're first starting out. So I guess just never give up on it. Never, be humble enough and empathetic enough to recognize that you don't know everything, and that if you are willing to learn and have a good attitude about it, you can kind of be successful in anything, right? Like I'm not the smartest engineer, but I show up on time and have a positive attitude most of the time, and that's been a lot to my success. Around the interface side, I just got into interfaces because I was curious about it. So maybe, at this level, most people, maybe some students aren't interested in going to interfaces, but be aware of your interact. Like the next time you get really frustrated with something, you like think about why you're being frustrated with it. Is it because it's not intuitive? You're not able to find something easily when you're searching or going through, with an interaction. And then, try to think about always, even construction management students, I tell them this, if you are working to make the work behind you in your job easier, so if you're a designer and you make the contractor's job easier because you could do good details, you're scheduled, you actually show an image of that light fixture they're supposed to install, not just a model number, you will always have a job. If you're the contractor and you make the facility manager's job, you label everything, give them nice shop drawings, all that, or maybe even as-built. It's like, if you work to make the people that work behind you in a work system their job easier, you will always be successful in life.
That's good
And
advice.
to the more kind of like, I guess, industry folks, particularly the folks maybe in the mechanical side of the world, and I have to remind this to our Annex X pals sometimes, right? Sometimes as researchers, we have a tendency, we do research that's easy because life is hard, right? And this is around the context of automation. So automation fundamentally should support human performance. That really came out of aerospace, right? When we put automation into aeronautical context, it's to support human performance. It's not to save energy in the plane, right? And so where the built environment is, where we're having a proliferation of automation, that's a quick way to make a bunch of systems not be accepted by humans, right? So the
Yeah.
whole building automation industry in the commercial sector has been very successful, but they're looking at building performance. They're not looking at human performance, right? If I'm
Yeah.
sitting in my office and my lights cut off because I haven't wiggled enough in my chair and we save a couple kilowatt hours, but now, I trip and fall over the, trying to get the lights back on. Like that's a good example of, so resist the urge to automate away from people. Only use, automation should support human performance. And if we get make the buildings better because of that, that's a great byproduct. That's a win-win, or a win-win-win, as Michael Scott would say. But it should, if you lead with automation to save energy in buildings, then I can tell you right now we're on the slippery slide to failure. And that's, to me, that's where a lot of the, that's where I think we're going to see that come around, and it's just going to, keep things simple.
Yeah. Ah, that's some good stuff, Philip. That's good stuff.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. All right. See you soon.
Yeah.
All right, bye.